Chapter 9. The Harrowing of Pirin. The demon flames reached out for the fleet. Eruptions of warp energy lashed at the void. They burned and slashed, a storm and a web. The Blood Angel's battle barge, Lineage of Virtue, was the first caught in the nexus of the crossfire. Its void shields collapsed in seconds. Writhing beams of warp fire cut through the center of the hull. Conflagrations raced across all decks. The starboard engine exploded, blowing out a fifth of the hull's length, venting thousands of crew and scores of legionaries into space. Captain Athaniel's last Vox transmission was a vow to his brothers and to the Angel. "Our pyre shall be your shield," he said, and the Lineage of Virtue began its turn, exposing more and more of its port flank to the fortress, taking on the barrage, blocking at least some of it from the vessels in its lee. It kept turning, becoming a torch, and as the rest of the fleet pulled further away, racing for the shelter of the southern hemisphere of the planet, one last burst from the Virtue's port engine sent the ship plummeting towards the gate. By will or chance of fate, the Virtue held together until it crashed into the gate. The plasma sun of its explosion destroyed hundreds of square miles of demonic turrets. The effect was a pinprick. Yet the pinprick was enough to save at least the Blood Sun and the Encarnadine, which had been closest to the battle barge. Four more vessels from the combined fleets died before the expeditionary force put the planet between it and the turret fire. They died too suddenly, even to Vox a farewell.
"We have identified the planet,"
Calibus voxed the Primarchs.
"Enough of the topography of the southern hemisphere is unchanged. It is the Forge World, Pirin. We had refugees from it on Thrinos. It was visited by the Pilgrim."
Sanguinius walked across the Red Tears Bridge, taking in the portrait of the planet emerging from the combined rapid scans of the fleet as they developed on the arrays of Auspex screens. It was a small rocky world, not much larger than a planetoid, less than 3,000 miles in diameter. Steep mountain chains dominated much of the south, diminishing as they approached the equator. Tens of thousands of years of intensive mining in the once inhabited northern hemisphere had worn the peaks down. The composite images of the north showed the traces of human civilization and industry, now twisted almost past the point of recognition. Manufactoria, taller than the mountains they had replaced, belched fire and smoke into the world's eternal night. A spiral pillar, 500 miles wide, linked the north magnetic pole of Pirin to the bottom of the gate. It emerged from the greatest manufactorum, a jagged monster that rose from the surrounding terrain like two gigantic clawed hands clasped in prayer. There was no clear division between manufactorum and pillar. They flowed into one another, and the pillar flowed into the gate. The pillar shone with the light of molten matter. Sanguinius took what he saw with him to the hololith chamber. "Matter," he said to the images of his brothers. "Matter is being created at this juncture. We can observe it happening. The pillar grows from the manufactorum. The gate's being is forged here."
"We cannot be the planet's own matter," the lion said. "It is a speck compared to the gate. It would have been consumed a million times over by now."
"Well, there is nothing about what we are seeing that is rational," said Gilliman. His jaw was set with frustration. He said rational with something like bereavement. "This fortress is already impossible a million times over."
"Yet Pirin is somehow necessary to it," Sanguinius pointed out. "The impossible has attached itself to something real."
Gilliman's eyes widened in the hope of reason.
"An anchor," he said. "Well, the fortress needs to anchor itself in the material. Maybe Pirin's industry in the new configuration is a gateway, funneling in the warp substance, making it into stable matter."
"That conforms to what we are seeing," said Sanguinius. "The intensity of the energy suggests an important nexus of some sort. Brothers, I would thrust a sword into that heart and sever the connection."
Gilliman nodded.
"And destroy the forge. Shut down the flow of matter. Perhaps that might destabilize the gate."
"We are under attack," said the lion. "So we must now constitute a threat. The enemy does not want us on Pirin.
We can't move close enough to the target zone to stage a drop, said Gilliman. The defences will take the fleets apart before we could launch even a fraction of the ground forces we'll need. Sanguinius turned to the pict screen on his hololith podium and called up the topography of Piran's northern hemisphere. The northeast quadrant has the potential for a clear run, he said, north of the equatorial cordillera. It is primarily a region of plains.
I see it, said Gilliman.
The spaces between the foundries are wide.
Former transportation networks, said the lion.
Sanguinius changed the screen to show enemy movements on the surface. The activity is minimal, he said. All efforts are concentrated inside the manufactoria. The land is effectively empty. It will take time for the enemy to respond.
A ground advance might go far before encountering resistance, Gilliman agreed.
Sanguinius mentally traced the path from the mountains to the Great Forge, and the tactical situation became less important. He pictured the most savage strike he could bring to the demons. The wounds of Cygnus Prime were still fresh. He would heal them with this assault. The Blood Angels would hit the demons with maximum force. There would be anger, but no loss of control. Not this time. There would be atonement through disciplined fury. There could be a precision and a majesty in wrath. This was the lesson he and his sons would bring to the abominations. The Thunderhawk Kurashi's fire left the Sothanellus and plunged towards the atmosphere of Piran. Now that he finally saw it, the work of the pilgrim filled Calibus with both disgust and awe. Seated opposite him in the troop compartment, accompanied by five of his legionaries, Levanus said, "The tales of the refugees did not begin to do these horrors justice."
"The changes had only just begun when they fled," said Calibus. "Otherwise, they would never have escaped the system."
"I've seen,"
Ironfather Cruax growled, echoing Calibus's disgust.
"It is an insult to the purity of the machine."
Calibus nodded. The Forge World's transformation was offensive as well as monstrous. The Sothanellus had encountered demons during its long and isolated war. The abominations were confirmation of everything the 10th Legion had come to despise about the flesh. They were its deformation, its corruption, its overwhelming excess. They were proof of its weakness, because it could be remade in such a fashion. But the metamorphosis of Piran brought the same monstrosity to the machine. The Great Forge and its link to the gate were a brutal refutation of any kind of purity.
"This obscenity will not stand,"
Calibus said to Cruax.
"On this day, it falls."
"That won't be enough," said Cruax.
"No, it won't,"
Calibus agreed. "This will not stop until we find the pilgrim," said Levanus.
"Then we will,"
said Calibus.
"Before Terra or after, we will hunt it and we will destroy it."
"So it shall be," Levanus said. What had been a hope became a vow. The legions came down on Piran. Hundreds of drop pods at a time burned through the atmosphere. They were a hail of iron, the sky falling upon the land in one storm after another.
"Are there any humans left below?"
Kletos asked. The drop pod shook and hammered down through the thin atmosphere.
"Doubtful," said Hyrax. "There is no sun. The only heat is from the foundries."
He shook his head once.
"No, there's nothing to save here." "Well, I didn't think so."
"Why did you ask?"
"An idle thought, Captain. I wondered what they would think, were they to look up."
"They would know they had not been forgotten," Hyrax said. "But be assured, legionary, we have witnesses. They may not know it yet, but they are learning what their annihilation looks like." The drop pod's retro rockets fired. The grav harness strained against Kletos's shoulders with the sudden deceleration. He grinned fiercely, anticipating the bone-jarring jerk of the landing. It came, and the pod's hatch doors blew open, slamming down on the basalt surface of Piran. Kletos stormed out of the pod with the rest of the squad, behind his captain, joining the mustering of the second destroyers. Overhead, the contrails of drop pods and lifters clawed the sky, scarring it with silver trails.
east and west and south of where Kletos stood, the lava plane trembled with the landings and the gathering forces of the Ultramarines and Dark Angels. There were far fewer pods coming down in the north. The destroyers were in the vanguard. The fortress was still over the horizon. The march would not be a long one before it appeared. The fleets were anchored low, almost grazing the mesosphere, and they had come as far forwards as they could while still remaining shielded from the ship-killing cannons before beginning the drops. Kletos could remember a time when Gilliman had been reluctant to unleash the destroyers. That had begun to change after the Thoas campaign. After Kalth, he had been much freer in using the brutal weapon they were. And here was a world where the concept of mercy was inconceivable. Kletos had no illusions about the kind of warrior he was. The second destroyers were the side of the Ultramarines that was not celebrated in chronicles or in murals. They were the warriors of hard necessity, of scorched earth and of weaponry many would prefer not to think about. They fought with no less discipline and no less a faithful application of the Primarch's precepts than any other company. But alchemy weapons and rad bombs were messy. The wars of the destroyers were messy. There was no pretending their campaigns were anything else except the brutal extermination of the foe. So they had proven aboard the Annunciation. So they would prove again on Pirin. This was a mission of annihilation. Rhinos rumbled forwards to the drop pods and lowered their loading ramps. Kletos followed Hierax into the Blood of Honor. The heavy armor landings were a continuous earth tremor. Next to Kletos, Manassan grumbled.
Oh, more city, no marching.
There will be plenty of marching, Hierax said, but speed is the watchword of our advance. Tell me, legionary, are you opposed to reaching the enemy faster?
No, Captain, I'm not. Please consider me happily resigned to sit a bit longer.
So noted, Hierax said. He cocked his head, listening to his vox-speed. When the loading ramp clanged shut, he banged a gauntleted fist against the bulkhead separating the troop compartment from the driver.
"Teosos!" he barked. "The order is given. Take us forwards."
The Blood of Honor lurched forwards, accelerating quickly. The Rhino was hungry for battle. The armored columns roared across the wide plain of Pirin. Hierax opened the roof hatch of the Rhino to man the pintle-mounted storm bolter and to witness the charge. For miles on either side of him, for many more to the rear, tanks and armoured transports in the blue and black of two legions covered the land and filled the air with choking clouds of exhaust. The air of Pirin was thin and cold, and only the infernal heat of the foundries prevented the atmosphere from freezing and falling to earth. The smell of the engine fumes came in through the filters of Hierax's helmet rebreather. He welcomed the stench of human machinery. It represented order. It was the hard, burnt tang of reason going to war. Half a mile to his right, the Land Raider, Flame of Illyrium, advanced between the columns to lead the charge. It was the Primarch's command vehicle, and Gilliman rode in the upper hatch, pointing the way forwards, a living monument of gold and blue, taking his sons to burn their way through the enemy. Hierax couldn't see the lead elements of the Dark Angels from this distance, but he was willing to wager the Lion was as visible to them as the Avenging Sun was to his legionaries. Hierax's heart swelled with the pride of crusade.
"Hierax!" Iasus voxed. "What say you?"
Hierax glanced to his left, to where the chapter master rode as he did.
"I say this is a sight long past due," he answered.
The sight was of the unity of the Emperor's loyal legions, of determination and of their crushing strength. For several more minutes, Hierax consciously gave himself leave to revel in the sweep and storm and majesty of the tide of armour. Then the fortress began to appear over the horizon. The black, infinite wall ate the sky. The ruined storm disappeared behind it. Darkness and red flame climbed higher and higher, swallowing the sky, becoming the sky. Hierax felt its inconceivable mass pressing down. He was suddenly aware of the horror of scale. The world on which so vast a display of Legion might was advancing was less than a speck beneath the demonic construction. Hyrax lowered his gaze, bringing all of his attention to bear on the land before him, pushing the monster in the sky to the edge of his consciousness. He stared straight ahead, a motionless sentinel. The hours passed. The Ultramarines and Dark Angels covered hundreds of miles towards their goal. The land was uneven but battered down, the rock so rounded by erosion it was a faded corpse of topography. At last, far ahead, belching smoke, the first of the forges came into view. They were pointed, twisted silhouettes. They looked like torn fragments of the night spewing flame. In the endless red-lit gloom, there was movement on the ground.
Captain, Teossus voxed, we have contacts ahead. I see them.
The land appeared to be boiling. He was too far away to make out the details. The motion of the demonic mass made him think of insect swarms. There was a suggestion of inhuman limbs and shapes in the jerking, flapping, skittering approach of the abominations. This was a tide, too, and it was everything the Ultramarines and Dark Angels were not. It was undisciplined. Closer now, the wave of the enemy was filled with competing currents. It was chaos, rushing to repel the invading order. Hyrax closed his grip on the storm bolter. He gauged the shrinking distance between the two forces, calculating the moment he would begin to fire. He predicted the precise second the longer-range guns of the land raiders began to thunder. He nodded as solid lines of artillery blasts engulfed the leading edge of the demonic charge. He could see the exact spot on the barren ground where the mailed fist of the legions would slam into the jaws of the demons. Without asking Teossus, he knew how far they were from the primary target. Still far. Too far to punch through without committing to a long campaign. One that the demons, with their infinite resources, would win. The charge had been fast. It had summoned the enemy to the battlefield. The demons were rushing to stop the threat of two legions. Now was the time for the true speed of the attack. Now was the time for the third legion. And because it was time, Hyrax allowed himself to look up once more. The firmament screamed. The sky above Piran was filled with crimson anger. Squadrons of blood angels, stormbirds, streaked over the battlefield in the direction of the Great Forge. There were so many engines howling at maximum velocity that Hyrax could hear them over the grinding rumble of the tanks. The glare of the exhausts was a purging light, brighter than the baleful flickering glow of the fortress. The gunships were the Warhawk IV model, winged giants, each carrying 100 Legiones Astartes. If the tanks of the 13th and 1st Legions were a battering ram into the mass of the demons, the 9th Legion was a hurling spear into the foe's heart. Hyrax watched the flight of angels until his internal sentinel signalled the coming of yet another movement. He faced forwards again and opened fire with the Stormbolter. The Warhawk Talon of Baal flew over a land begging for flame. Sanguinius stood at the open side door. He held on to the bulkhead and leaned out into the wind, looking towards the great forge and the pillar linking it to the gate. The speed of the Talon blurred the enemy below, turning the demons into a grasping abstraction. Bursts of psychic fire lashed upwards at the stormbirds. It was scattered. The demons' attention was still concentrated on the ground attack. The Manufactorum reared ahead. It had appeared at first like a broad-shouldered mountain, a volcano of warp-altered industry. The Blood Angels flew between lesser forges, large as mountain chains. They held traces of the human constructs they had once been, now distorted by immensity. Chimneys were thousands of feet high. Conduits were half a mile thick. Vaulted archways had turned into fanged maws, iron and flesh and stone indistinguishable. The primary Manufactorum dwarfed them all. As it filled Sanguinius's sight, he could see here too the echo of the thing it had been. At his side, Raldoron asked, "How will we know what to attack inside?" "Look,"
said Sanguinius. You can see the essence of what was taken by the enemy. The principles of the construction have some of the human in them. The Manufactorum was built of monoliths the size of hive cities, but it was still recognizable. It was still a foundry.
They use us, said Raldoron. Everything about us.
Yes. Do you see what that means? At some level, they need us as the foundations. Or our horror is simply the worse for seeing the human endeavour made monstrous, he thought. What we know, we can fight, he said. What we can fight, we can destroy. They know us well enough to fracture us along every weakness. Time we turn that principle against them. The Talon of Baal angled downwards. The main gate of the foundry was visible now, illuminated by the glow of industry within. It was 20 miles high and 10 wide. Its iron doors were open, vomiting forth an endless stream of demons. They scraped against the basalt ground as they closed, striking comet tails of sparks. The movement was slow, the march of glaciers towards collision. Past the gate, the foundry was a hive of tunnels, clearly too small for the warhawks. The squadrons of immense gunships made for the terrain immediately before the gate. At the rate the doors were closing, the Blood Angels would have several minutes yet before the way in was barred. Hellstrike missiles flashed from beneath the wings of the Stormbirds. The hard rain became a sea of fire. Nose and wing-mounted autocannons opened up, hammering the ground through the spreading fireballs. The squadrons hit with the full complement of their heavy weaponry. It was an assault that would have vaporized a human force. Clouds of dust rose, enveloping the gunships as they dropped planetwards. The downdrafts of their engines whirled the stone fragments into scouring cyclones. The Stormbirds landed on ground blackened by fire, the loading ramps coming down at the same instant that the landing gear made contact. Thousands of Blood Angels disembarked, the sound of ceramite boots on metal a pounding counterpoint to the descending whine of the engines. The terrain for a few moments was clear of the enemy. The bombardment had melted rock. Clusters of shell craters overlapped. Everywhere Sanguinius looked as he led the way forwards from the gunships, he saw demons reduced to twitching, hissing pools. Carbonized bodies liquefied as they came apart at a fundamental level, losing their grip on the materium. Desultory blue and violet light, sick with the taint of the warp, flickered over the sludge. The gunships took off again immediately. Their pilots headed back the way they had come, turning their autocannons on the mass of demons to the rear, holding them back. Monstrous howls filled the thin air. The demons understood the strategy being used against them and were trying to counter it. Sanguinius hoped the Stormbirds would buy him a few more seconds, during which he would only have to fight on one front. The doors continued to close. Sanguinius looked up at them slowly scraping their way along the ground. Their edges, unnaturally straight, the tops invisible in the far heights, were less than 500 yards apart now. The narrowing gap had slowed the rush of demons to the battlefield, though the baying horde that ran and leapt and crawled and danced towards the Blood Angels was large enough. In the mass was a terrible plenty of forms. The monsters were things of disease and excess and wrath and unceasing change. Reality frayed at the edges of the demon army, unravelled by their presence and their numbers. Eyeing the ferocity of the charge, Ascalon said,
"They do not want us inside."
"They do not," Sanguinius agreed, "and that in itself shows that we are on the right path." With the Primarch and the Sanguinary Guard forming the tip of the spear, the Blood Angels charged forwards to meet the enemy, bolters and las cannons striking out ahead of them. As the first of the demons fell, Sanguinius voxed the Legion. "My sons, today we purge the memory of Cygnus Prime. Hold fast to your anger, but preserve its righteousness. Hone it. Be its master. Through it, let us thirst only for victory. And nothing else. We will be tempted. We will not fall. Not again, and not with my brothers as witnesses. If we fall again today, then the war is over. The power that built this fortress will have the galaxy as its plaything." He switched the channel to a private one. Amit. He spoke to his troubled son. Do you hear me?
I do. And I understand.
Good. But bring justice to the abominations, Amit. Be our vengeance. He gave license to Fifth Company and its captain. Tear them asunder. The spear of the Blood Angels plunged into the mass of the demons. There was no pause in the weapons fire. Mass reactive shells burst warp flesh apart. Laz burned it to ash. The demons did not fall as living things did. They kept coming, missing arms and legs, torsos punctured by wounds that should have been lethal. But they had become matter, and so were subject to destruction. Sanguinius swung the blade and carmine through the body of a thing whose flesh was the pink of a drowned newborn. The monster's liquid howl became a doubled burbling squall as the flesh darkened to the blue of suffocation and the two halves sprouted new limbs. The babbling maws of the beasts fastened onto his legs. As he cut them down with two swift strokes, a scream descended upon him, a scream of reason shredded, of hope turned into the anguish of doom. At its sound, the pain of his fate rose in his chest, and despair mocked the futility of every effort. The scream was a psychic javelin. It sought to transfix him, to drive his soul into the earth and hold it there, writhing, helpless before the predator. Sanguinius defied the paralysis and jerked his head up. The two horrors had held him in place long enough to make him the target of a flying demon. Its sinuous tail sliced the air as if swimming. Talons lined the edges of its wings. Its maw was framed by horns as long as a man's arm. Another demon rode its back. It was the same revolting pink as the abomination Sanguinius had dispatched, but its limbs were longer, muscled. Its horned head was jewelled with necklaces of golden bones. Two of its three hands held a curved dagger and a flesh-bound book. The third was open. The demon extended it towards Sanguinius, revealing an azure eye in its palm. The demon cocked its head as if in greeting, and psychic energy blasted from the eye. Jittering lightning struck Sanguinius in the chest and wrapped itself around him. Change, hard and cold and inexorable, reached through his armour, into his marrow, into his mind. The demon chanted, its voice twining around the scream of its mount. The words were beyond his understanding. No human tongue could make their shape. Yet they drove even deeper into the heart of the angel's being. They called up fate like a stone, a cold yet molten stone, diamond and lava, the unalterable and the consuming. Horus's blade pierced him once more, and beyond that pain was a darkness. It was not the abyss of his death. It was formed of the consequences of his death. The attack, the words, the agony and the vision all took barely a second to transpire. Sanguinius shouted, defying the paralysis that pulled at his limbs and soul. If my fate is decreed, then I do not die here. The demon's attack meant nothing, and with his left hand he thrust the spear of Telesto upwards, impaling the winged demon through its maw. He arrested its flight with that single gesture, grounding himself against the impact of its mass. The head of the spear tore through the upper jaw and emerged through the top of the demon's flat head. Impaled, the abomination shrieked mindlessly. It lashed its body around Sanguinius, spines gouging the surface of his armour. The rider sank the talons of its feet into the back of the monster and kept its position. It ignored the flailing wings and tail. The eye in its hand unleashed jagged blue lightning. The demon held the book higher, and it chanted the words of its pages with greater ferocity and greater knowledge.
I know you, it seemed to be saying. I know everything you will say and do, and how you will end. I know how this battle will end. I know you, and you are the one who is impaled.
It struck downwards with its twisted blade. Sanguinius blocked it with the blade and carmine. His movement felt slow, as if he were a puppet straining against his strings. Fate was inevitable, yet change tormented his frame, seeking to bend him to a new, more terrible arc, blackening the meaning of his death, turning sacrifice into atrocity. He pushed back against the demon.
The blades scraped against each other. Crimson and violet light collided. Flames that burned and flames that sliced made war against each other. The flying demon sank lower on the spear. Its flesh boiled away from the weapon's touch, and it wrapped the length of its tail around the author of its pain. The horned demon chanted, and its eyes blazed in mockery.
I know you.
Sanguinius hurled his strength against the demon. The blade en carmine began to slice through the edge of the abomination's sword. His peripheral vision caught movement on his right. Something huge had broken through the sanguinary guard. It was charging him. Gold flashed to his left. His herald leapt past him, attacking in such a blur of speed that Sanguinius would have sworn he saw the flash of wings carrying the herald upwards. He landed beside the three-armed demon and drove his power blade through the side of its head. The warp light vanished. The book fell from the demon's grasp. The charging beast was almost upon him. Sanguinius turned in the coils of the winged demon with such force that he shredded the creature's muscle. The spear of Telesto was caught in the monster's body, but he swung the blade en carmine over his head as he turned. He brought it down with a roar. He hit his target before he could truly register what it was. Behind his blow was all his rage at the paradoxes of his fate, its certain arrival and uncertain meaning. He struck at the powers that laid claim to knowing him and the purpose of his being. The sword hit the skull of a demonic beast. Scarlet of hide and of armour, a single razored horn rising from its forehead, its jaws were parted in rabid rage. It had trampled one of the sanguinary guard beneath hooves of brass, pounding the legionary into a mass of pulp and splintered ceramite. All this Sanguinius took in after his blow. The blade split the monster's skull in two. The blazing eyes fell to either side, their wrath flaring once more, then fading as dissolution took hold of the behemoth. Its legs buckled on the instant, and it slammed into the ground. The sword-wielding demon that rode its back was pitched forwards. Bolter fire took it apart before it landed. Sanguinius leaned into the collision, crushing the winged demon's coils between his armour and the fallen beast. Demonic flesh merged and melted. Freed, he spread his wings and took to the air. Sanguinius hovered briefly over the melee. The herald had only just withdrawn his blade from the body of the chanting demon. He saluted the angel and turned back to the fray. The war called, yet Sanguinius felt compelled to watch the herald a moment longer. He had the vertiginous impression of seeing himself wade into the crush of monsters. Amit had detached his company from the main advance, leading his men in an arc around the edges of the flood of demons pouring from the gate. Now he took them back in, cutting across the flow before the doorway. Amit sent a flight of rockets just ahead of them. The legionaries charged into the dust of the explosions. They went in fast, reckless in fury, bolters and blades punishing the reeling monsters while the fireballs were still fading. Amit's anger was who he was, and it could take him too far. But it was not the thirst. It was the shadow of the Blood Angel's nobility, the brutal reality of warfare. They aspired to the sun, but they drew blood too. Right now, the burst of Fifth Company's anger was the exemplar for the Legion. The main advance of the Blood Angels was less than 100 yards from the narrowing gap between the doors. The swirl of demons was confused. There were fewer emerging from the Manufactorum, and the ones at the entrance were striking out in every direction, momentarily unsure of the primary threat. Sanguinius rose higher, faster, his wings beating hard against the thin air to hold him aloft, the confluence of events giving him speed.
"Lord Primarch,"
Ascalon voxed. Sanguinius was pulling away from his escort.
"Be ready," Sanguinius told him. "We are about to take the forge. All heavy weapons," Sanguinius voxed. "Fire forwards and fire now."
Las cannons and rockets by the hundreds obeyed his command a second later. The sudden holocaust cut through the ranks of the demons, punching craters in rock and gouging out trenches of incinerated warp flesh. Sanguinius streaked downwards, and he was another flame, a comet of war. He held the spear of Telesto before him as he flew to the nexus of demons. He charged the spear with the psychic force of the angelic war and unleashed its judgment. The beam was a blinding sear in the gloom of Pirin. It sliced through clusters of sinuous, hooved, long-necked abominations. It turned them into ash. Sanguinius flew in on the path of the beam, wings folding back. Spear extended and blade sweeping before him, his descent was a bloody streak. He decapitated demons with the speed and force of his strike. He was unstoppable. He landed just ahead of Amit's company. He stood between the closing doors, their edges wide as mountain faces rumbled in. The ground shook without cease. Around Sanguinius, demons of wrath closed in, swords raised. Their numbers looked thin. Too many had rushed forward to try to counter Fifth Company. Before Sanguinius were the mouths of thousands of tunnels, blurring in the great heights above. The demons had stopped their advance. They were on the defensive, guarding the entrances. Some capered, eager for the Blood Angels to make their assaults. The creatures of disease rang bells, so many that the funereal clamour rivaled the grinding thunder of the doors. Sanguinius attacked the abominations trying to encircle him. They stalked forwards on hoofed legs that angled backwards. With their long, curving horns and crimson skin, they truly were the demons of ancient Terran myth. In the crimson of their hide, though, Sanguinius saw a dark mirror of his legion's colours. The demons came to fight angels, but in their snarling rage they were the image of the angels' threatened fall. Sanguinius fought them in a sweeping run, hitting them like a scythe. He deflected swords and cut abominations in half. The spear of Telesto flashed again, burning purity, sending the rage that walked back into the abyss of the warp. The deep thudding of bolters and the snarl of chainswords drew closer. The din of war echoed up the edges of the doors. Less than 200 yards of space remained. Fifth Company broke through at the same time as the Sanguinary Guard. Amit and Ascalon converged on Sanguinius. Amit's armour dripped with ichor. His breathing rasped from his helm grill. It was almost a snarl. "Captain Amit," Sanguinius said, "are you the master of your anger?"
"I am, Lord."
The breathing became slightly more regular.
"We all are."
"That is well. Then we go forwards." The main body of Blood Angels was between the doors now. The legionaries marched shoulder to shoulder, their boots tramping in unison. They were a single mass, indivisible, unstoppable. They left a stinking, dissolving wake of foulness behind them. The Stormbirds maintained their bombardment, concentrating their fire on a smaller area as the closing doors hampered the attempts of the demon army to return to the Manufactorum. The Ninth Legion moved at a brutal run between the doors, racing to get through before they shut with crushing finality. There was a mile of open floor between the doors and the tunnel mouths. The surface was metal, though it looked like knotted flesh. With the Sanguinary Guard as point again, Sanguinius crossed the threshold in the Manufactorum and directed the phalanxes to the left and right. "We take the widest halls," he ordered. "One company in each path. Captains, choose your terrain to fight upon."
"What are we looking for?" Raldoron asked.
"We'll know when we find it," Sanguinius answered. "Believe that this is still a Manufactorum. We can destroy its ability to function without having to destroy the structure itself. Go now, for Baal, for Terra, and the Emperor." He was running forwards as he spoke. His army was spreading out behind him, escaping the doors. He chose the central hall for the Sanguinary Guard and First Company. Halfway across the floor of the towering vestibule, Sanguinius looked back. The doors were almost closed. The last of the Blood Angels were inside. He could just see a narrow slit, flickering with the flames of the battle outside the Manufactorum.
"Brothers,"
he voxed Gilliman and the Lion, "we are inside."
"Well fought," said the Lion. "We will scrape the land clear of the abominations for your extraction."
"Does the interior suggest how you can shut the forge down?" Gilliman asked. "I would think..." Vox contact with the exterior of the Manufactorum cut off. The doors closed with a tectonic boom. As Sanguinius led the march to the central tunnel to where demons gibbered and snarled and chanted, a psychic shudder rippled through the immense forge. It passed over Sanguinius. It was the touch of malevolent sentience. It felt like a welcome.